Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I'm Rob Nelson.
I'm Mike Bakoven, and here we are at the end of the season. We've had quite the run of six episodes, and we're closing out season four with something that we ought to know a little bit about.
Yeah, well, today we're going to be talking about the history of collections and collecting and just sort of antiques in general.
And how do we go about that? Because when I think of people who collect things, you know, you guys have a giant collection as curators here at the museum, but we also have people who take that collection and use it. And I imagine we get into that a little bit.
Yeah. So in the first segment, we're going to be talking with Kay Sanova, who's our director of interpretation here. And her and I are going to discuss sort of the differences in how a museum like Stir Museum collects and how the private citizen collects in their own spare time and develops their own crafts and hobbies of collecting.
Yep. And then as we've been doing more frequently, we get out of the bounds of the museum and go talk to Jim Pohl at Heartland Antique Mall. You might remember him from the Grand Theater episode, and talk about what it's like to kind of be in an antique shop full time.
We happened across a few dealers there as well, who are just going about the daily business of seeing after their own collection in the store. It was a good time.
That's great. Do you know what kind of antique dealer shatters things?
I don't.
That's a broker.
God.
All right, let's get into it.
Yeah, let's do it. And we're back with another episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I am joined today by Kay Sanova, Director of Interpretation here at Stir Museum. Kay, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Today, we are going to jump in and talk about collecting and the history of collections and their various forms. I think it's a really interesting topic that kind of took me in some different directions.
It's something that's kind of been near and dear to my heart for a really long time.
Yeah, I think both you and I have certain experiences with collectors, being in antique malls, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think it kind of comes with the territory of being into history and being around artifacts and all that stuff.
Long before I ever would even consider being a part of a museum. I was 13 when I bought my first antique.
So there you go. And I think I was probably around the same age. I actually remember the first thing that I remember that was engaging for me, that like drew me to history, was I lived in front of a railroad track that they converted into a bike trail.
Oh, yeah.
And when they tore it up, it just became this huge like dirt mud pit. And I spent a lot of afternoons after school just like digging in the dirt. I would find all these abandoned train parts, railroad spikes and hitches and stuff. And I just totally felt like Indiana Jones. And
well, I have a similar thing. The house that I live in now was the house that my folks built. And I later found out that was part of the Peters farm. But when they were trenching to put in services and things like that as the neighborhood was built up, they would churn up all these things, like a glass egg that you used in a hen house, parts of frying pans, dishes. We can dig in our backyard in our garden area and still find some things back there. So I have a sort of little snippets of those things collected that we found. And when I look at the aerial maps, the historic aerial maps, it looks like the area that they were digging was kind of where there was a privy.
Oh.
Which makes sense that all these broken things would be in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is an antique? Let's start there. I feel like there might be different definitions depending on what we're talking about.
I think that you could probably come up with a whole lot of different definitions. To me, an antique has always been something old, something that, and it's relative, because if you talk to somebody, say, a young person today and ask them what an antique is, they're going to say something from the 1990s.
Yeah.
And to me, something antique usually will either predate me or be very from a very early part of my life. But there's also, you know, there's the ancient antiques that go back hundreds of years. So I think it just depends upon who you're talking to and what that personal definition is.
Yeah, and I also think there's something to be said for what country you come from.
Yes.
With this topic. There, like one of my favorite sayings, and I feel like I say this all the time, is there's only two differences between British people and Americans. One is that British people think 100 miles is a long way.
Yes.
And the other one is that Americans think 100 years is a long time.
Yes.
And I think that just says it all. Like when we talk about something being, this is from the 1800s, there's just so much wow factor to it. And then if you go to England and you say, this object's from 1850, they go, big whoop.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in my bar that's 1,000 years old.
Yeah, look at this thing that is like 1,000, 2,000 years old. Hey, you know.
Yeah, so no big deal. One of the things that goes along with this is collections. Where does this whole story begin? You know, how do we get to an institution like Sturm Museum where we're sitting right now from the collections of antiquity?
Well, people have been collecting for thousands of years. Humans started going away from the nomadic form of life, you know, 12,000 years ago, they started, once they could be in one spot, they would start collecting things.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it would be really hard to haul a collection around with you. Oh, well, I know people who have hauled their collections around with them.
Sure.
But it goes back to ancient times. And so, but the things that were collected changed over time as humans evolved.
One of the first things that I found, and, you know, as a kid, I collected coins myself, just
rocks.
Kind of rocks. Yeah. So there you go. One of the things I found was as early as Caesar Augustus, the first emperor of Rome, 27 BC, he was a coin collector, it is alleged. So at least 2,000 years ago, there was a trade of, you know, people being interested in holding onto these coins for more than their monetary value.
That points out an interesting, you know, because when you start talking about collecting things of value, that usually, especially in the earliest times, tended to be the thing that the rich would do.
Yeah.
You know, the poor people didn't have the means to collect things of significant value. They might collect other things, but they would not collect things that would cost them money.
So, I mean, that's kind of how it starts off. In Europe, you have wealthy patrons who collect very fine art, also animals and other specimens of the natural world that they feel are unique. I feel like that sort of stuff begins to happen around the age of colonization and like new world discovery. People are interested in these new exotic animals from all over the world.
Exotic animals, exotic plants, anything that's unique and different from the things that they're used to, they're going to collect. I mean, the voyages of discovery by different peoples, they would collect things and take them back and just basically as a way to say, see what I found?
Because yeah.
It was something unique and different and it got people excited about maybe going and seeing the place themselves.
Yeah, it's really a long, fascinating history. I'm sure not everybody out there might be as interested in the history of the museum craft, but that's really where our origins begin. And, you know, you follow that trajectory from antiquity until the Middle Ages, Renaissance, and then you begin to see some sort of a structure around, I'd say, the late 18th century with what could be considered like a recognizable museum proper.
Yeah. But they kind of predate with something called Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yes.
As early as the 15th century. For that, I like the name Wunderkammer, which is Cabinets of Wonder, which is another name for Cabinets of Curiosities. And there's an interesting book that I read called Cabinet of Curiosities, but it turns out to be a crime novel with Agent Pendergast, one of my favorite characters. But it talks about this very exotic Cabinet of Curiosities that this person collects and all these unique, weird things. And you tend to sometimes you look at Cabinet of Curiosities as weird things, but it's tied to that collecting aspect, and some aspects of Cabinet of Curiosities eventually turns into museums.
Yeah, I found a description of Charles Wilson Peale's Cabinet of Curiosities in Philadelphia, which first opens in 1786. And in that, there were several portraits of George Washington, other notable political heroes of that time, general heroes of that time. But they're also bones of a woolly mammoth. Mm-hmm. So everything from the, you know,
anything and everything. And
yeah.
There's a famous painting about that shows Peel pulling back a curtain and showing off all of his things, the wonders behind the curtain.
Absolutely. And that kind of takes us into the 19th century, and then there's the birth of different sorts of institutions that aren't necessarily museums, but they're, you know, historic homes, and they have those monikers like so-and-so died here.
Or so-and-so slept here.
Yeah.
As we go through time, people would recognize that different places would have some type of either historical or emotional significance, and so they would try to save these places as a way to show off, you know, usually associated almost always with a famous person, so that they could, this is how this person lived. And they would have all of the personal effects and all of the decorations in the house, and all of that would be collected in this. Today they're called house museums,
mm-hmm.
but they would be a way to show anything and everything about the life of this person.
Yeah. So how does something like that differ from what we do today in the museum industry? Like, how does somebody's personal collection get treated differently at a historical institution today?
Well, the museum industry has really kind of professionalized over the years. As time grew on, it became kind of, it recognized that we needed to kind of get our ducks in a row and make sure that we follow best practices and things like that. But one of the important things that a museum might do that's different from a private collector is try to find out about the provenance of the artifact. To basically its origins. What's the story behind it? Because when you have that story, then you can interpret that artifact. We also have kind of requirements for the care of things that a lot of private collections, I've seen some private collections that are in absolutely cringeworthy storage conditions, and so it's something that's a little bit scary. Another thing is exhibitions, because you would have a way to professionally mount an exhibition of the artifacts and show them off in a way that helps. It's also, and it's tied very closely, an exhibition is often an interpretation or a guidance to interpretation of an artifact. And so you would have a way to explain the significance, the why, the how, the what, maybe the material composition of thing, you know, basically do a real deep look at what a particular artifact or collection of artifacts is. And probably the last thing, or one of the last things, would be the interpretation. Because while an exhibit is an interpretation of artifacts, we also here at Stern Museum interpret artifacts by having items that we can actually use and demonstrate,
yeah,
so that people can see how they were used and maybe make those connections to their daily life by viewing how they lived in the past and compare it with their life today.
And people specify that in the donation process. Again, like as Kay mentioned, we are a unique sort of institution where we have two separate collections, one that is for objects that are stored in perpetuity, meaning forever, not 50 years or 100 years, but literally as long as there will be a Hall County, Nebraska, these objects are going to be taken care of.
They're also significant for study. Other people from other institutions may come to study particular artifacts that are unique to us, or maybe they're a very rare piece.
Yeah, and that second collection, I think over 100 structures on our grounds. I'm not sure the exact number, but each of those structures has these use items in quotation marks that we use for that interpretation, for that education, to give people the opportunity for that hands-on learning experience.
And the structures themselves are artifacts as well.
Exactly. They aren't reproduction homes or reproduction stores.
Yeah,
these are
a few reproductions down there, but the vast majority of them are original structures. And one of the things that I've been working on is trying to make sure that we have all the documentation for the history of each of those structures, whether
yeah.
it is a reproduction constructed as an Eagle Scout project, or if it's an original section house from Buda over by Kearney. Just knowing all that, how we got it, when we got it, when it was built, all of these things is important. That's important information to help us tell a story.
Yeah, and I would just underline several times that the way that artifacts are housed at a museum is incredibly different than the way that in which they're cared for in somebody's traditional home. You know, I can't tell you how many times people have sought to donate an artifact to the collection, and you know, it's, well, where'd you have it? In the basement, where it was,
or the attic,
and you know, it's
garage.
Moth-eaten, eaten by insects, rodents. You know, it's damaged because of sunlight, because of heat, because of cold, because of mildew. You know, all these sorts of things. We do our best to mitigate and keep these artifacts in storage locations that are climate controlled, that are, you know, free of pests and other sort of damaging, you know.
Yeah, especially boxing or wrapping.
Yes.
That we need to do. We also have to make sure that the things that we receive, that we accept, are pest free.
Yes.
Because we don't want to introduce any pests into our collection, because we work really hard to protect the collection from these pests.
And including light, you know, light contamination. When these objects are on exhibit, I mean, a lot of people might not realize how damaging light can be, but if you've ever had an old photograph that's been, you know, sitting on somebody's dining room table for 50 years.
Fabric is really prone to fade.
Yeah, and you take it out of the frame, you can see the difference in that, you know, that light that has been on it versus the light that hasn't been on it.
Yeah, so you have to really think about, if you have something really old that's in a frame, you have to really think about where you put it. You don't want direct sunlight hitting it.
I'd like to transition for a second and just talk about the Sturm Museum collection a little bit more. We're talking about collectors from the old world. Does Sturm Museum have any notable large benefactors who have donated several items to the museum collection?
Well, and they're not a private, but the most notable one is the one that kind of got, was a big part of us starting out, was the Hall County Historical Society collection.
Sure.
And that was a massive amount of artifacts that they've been collecting since the 1920s that were turned over to the museum. And a lot of them are on exhibit or being used in one of the houses or in storage. But Walbeck also had some collections. I know he had some firearms that we received. And we also have a whole building dedicated to Gus Bonner, the Gus Bonner Memorial Rotunda, that houses all of his Native American and Western artifacts.
Yeah, that's the building that I feel like kind of has the most parallels to what we're talking about from the past.
Yes.
With, you know, this person who has this great collection of artifacts from his travels all over the world, you know, kind of. That's typically the story you see of these yep. European benefactors. And throughout their travels, they collect these incredibly rare, unique objects, and then they, you know, house them in such a way. But yeah,
Mr. Bonner was a unique individual, and he collected things. He was involved in some of the old West shows, Wild West shows. He was friends with Pawnee Bill, Buffalo Bill, and he often participated in some of the Wild West shows. He's reporters who have been involved in some of the early movie productions about Westerns. He collected Native American artifacts from across the country. He also collected and saved a lot of things that would be considered Old West artifacts and saddles and that type of thing. So those things are all housed in the rotunda and have been on exhibit for about 40 years now.
On a much larger scale, a similar story has taken place on the national level in America with the famous James Smithson example. For those of you who do not know who James Smithson is, you've probably heard of his namesake, the Smithsonian Institution. James Smithson was an English-born person who never actually set foot in the United States, yet he donated the equivalent of around $500,000 in his time in the early 19th century, which today I don't even know how much money that would be, but it would be.
I think I saw an equation that compared it was a very large number. Let's just say that.
Essentially, a person who was dedicated to the arts, to the sciences in his own personal life. He was an amateur chemist and mineralogist, Smithson, and just was dedicated to the idea that people should be citizens of the world. And he wanted to further education in this, you know, up-and-coming country.
Fledgling country, yeah.
Yeah, who was struggling to find its own sense of identity. And there were private collections around the United States in the early 19th century, and people were aware that, you know, there wasn't such an institution, but once they heard that Smithson was looking to donate this vast amount of wealth, there was this sort of consolidation of what this institution was going to be throughout the 1830s and 1840s.
Yeah, it took some time to get everything together, but now it's one of the most significant collections in the country. Basically, they're keeping track of a lot of America's history within all the assorted buildings that are now connected to the Smithsonian.
Yeah, I think there are over 19 actual like museums.
Yeah, I think there's some open spaces as well. I've not had the opportunity to go. I understand I need to live in D.C. for a year in order to do it right. I don't have time right now.
But the according to the original board of directors of what would become Smithsonian, the purpose of the institution was to create a space for all objects of art and foreign and curious research, and all objects of natural history, plants, and geological and mineralogical specimens belonging to the United States, which may be in the city of Washington, in whosoever custody they may be, shall be delivered thereto. That's very precise language, but
yes.
Sort of those are some of the areas of interest that people were looking into during that time, and it's become so much more in the years that followed.
They collect a lot. You know, if you want to see one of the sets from MASH, you go there. If you want to see something from Star Trek, you go there.
I have seen Abraham Lincoln's hat when I visited, and also the bullet that unfortunately killed him.
And they have all of the first ladies. They have dressed first ladies.
The Hope Diamond, I believe I saw there as well. And everything from the Hope Diamond to Archie Bunker's chair and the ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz.
There's several sets. There's a couple that are missing.
Oh.
There's been a whole documentary about it, about the restoration of the pair that they've got.
Okay.
It's really interesting.
Well, I know in the movie, or in the book, they were actually silver. And I'm not, I'm guessing because, you know, color movies were thing.
It was one of the earliest, because it transitions from black and white to a color movie. And so, ruby's going to show up much better than silver.
Yeah. Well, shifting gears a little bit, I wanted to talk a little bit more about collecting as a hobby in the modern era. I've spent some time working in an antique mall as a younger man. I've kind of seen the culture surrounding that environment, and I find it really fascinating. It's its own little world of collectors. Have you had experiences in this realm?
I have had experience with antique stores in Grand Island pretty much my entire life. I have had the honor of knowing many vendors over the years. I have had the honor also of being friends with a number of them. It is fun to have conversations. We have some really unique discussions talking about time periods, questions about different things, asking them for help to find specific things, listening to some of their stories of how they found a particular piece that's in their booth. It's really a lot of fun to visit and just spend time learning about some of the stuff and why they acquired certain things to put in their booth.
When I worked in an antique store, I found it really thought-provoking when just talking to some of these dealers. You know, I feel like you could get a sense of how their mind works and who they are as a person by what they collect and how they talk about it. I remember talking to a person who collected pocket watches. And then, you know, I asked him, well, why do you collect pocket watches? And he would just talk to me he would just light up and talk to me about like the internal workings of them and how they're all different. And some of the maker's marks are interesting to him. And, you know, where they were made is different than how they're made in other locations. And The same thing with other things, you know, like people, there's so many things that people collect. They collect pens or pins or coins or money. And
it used to be a time when people collected salt and pepper shakers.
Yeah.
They would collect, they gather them from all over the country or even foreign locations. I collected rocks as a kid. I still pick up rocks. There's little cubbies in my car where there's rocks. I can lay down a shower floor someday, maybe. I collected pitchers at one time, like creamer pitchers and that type of thing. But now I'm really into chickens. Anybody who knows me already knows that part. But I collect so much more 19th century textile sewing related things. It just depends upon where, because our interest in collecting, for the most part, doesn't stay static. It kind of evolves over time. And so something that might have been important to us 20 years ago may have morphed into something else. And you might still retain love for that, but your passions kind of evolve and move to a different direction.
Well, yeah, and as you learn more about your, you know, hobby of collecting, I think your interests change a little bit too. And, you know, sometimes you do complete a collection and it's, you know, time to move on from it. And, or along the way, while you're collecting something, you spend a lot of time in these antique stores or around these, you know, trade circuits sort of things. And something else catches your eye.
Yeah.
And so you get into that a little bit more, and that can lead you in a bad direction sometimes.
Usually I have to, you know, item either has to really kind of speak to me and kind of say, yeah, you really need to take me home. Or it's something that I'm looking for specifically to do some type of programming. Or it could be something that I'd never seen before, something that was really unique and different. And I just thought, well, I'll get that and I'll see where that takes me.
This is kind of touching home for me in a more personal way. I really have a fondness for material culture as an academic pursuit. I think museums are so much more inclusive of people than something like an academic paper. Mm-hmm. I think so many more people find something in a museum or in their own private collection and at an antique store that's super interesting and compelling and engaging to them in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. And I think objects have that power. Like, what the point I'm trying to make here is I think it's really cool.
Well, and see, material culture, which is the objects, the things that we collect, the personal, you know, the things that we use in our daily lives, the things we collect, all types of things, that's what material culture is. And if you think about, as a genealogist, I think about, you know, the lives of people with, and some of the interesting stories that they have. But then you look at the items that they used to possess and you think about, you know, how they would have used them, what stories, you know, they were in the room where this happened to this person and what story could they have told. But it's also the everyday objects, the all the cooking things. You look at a wooden spoon that has been used over time that we have in our collection, and you wonder just how many meals that spoon might have helped to make.
Yeah. In a similar note, when the Museum of African American History as part of the Smithsonian opened a few years ago, I was really moved by something then President Obama said in his speech when he was there at the opening ceremonies. And he was wandering through their collections before they opened. He had like a behind the scenes pass, of course, which is something I would dream about. But he came across a slave block that just simply read Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay spoke here in 1830. That's what the slave block said. And that right there said so much, you know. At 1830, a slave block where every day, day after day, year after year, people were taken from their families, sold into slavery, you know, had their lives stolen from them. And on this slave block where hundreds of feet stood to, you know, be sold against their will, what's remembered with a plaque on this slave block is these two politicians spoke here once. And that just says so much about that period. And, you know, that's what I'm talking about with the power of objects. Like, you can't capture that in a paper. You just can't do it, in my opinion.
The emotion that artifacts can provoke, it can be really significant. I was in Dallas, and we went, of course, to the book repository. And I was a little kid when the assassination occurred. But to be in that place, to look down from that location, to see all these items that had been collected as a part of this, provoked some extremely strong emotions. There were people in touring that exhibit that day who were crying, that were, you know, significantly moved by watching the video reels, by looking at the different artifacts that were collected as a part of this exhibit, to actually see the space, that personal connection, because anybody who is of a certain age may have some type of remembrance of that. It's just like when the space shuttle blew up, I knew exactly where it was and what I was doing, and it's something that's always going to stick with me. The Twin Towers coming down, people remember these things. But then there's pieces of the Twin Towers that are touring, and to be close to that tangible object, maybe not to get to touch it, but to be close to that, it provokes strong emotion in people. And that's what one of the powers that I think artifacts and collecting has.
Yeah, it's less removed. It's less further away. Or like not.
It becomes a real part of your life.
Yeah, in a way that maybe something written just doesn't.
Yeah, it doesn't quite.
Doesn't quite do it. Well, I think we're gonna, you know, come to an end of this segment here. I think we've talked long enough for this.
Yeah, I think we could probably talk for a couple, 3 more hours.
But I'll ask you one more thing, since this is something I like to do that I've developed. But do you have a favorite story from history that involves the subject of collecting?
The subject of collecting, well, I think, because I really was trying to think of a lot of different things about this, but I have to hearken to living history museums. And it was in 1891 that one of the first recognized living history, or at that time they were calling them open air museums, opened Skansen in Stockholm. And so it was a collection of buildings and places where they were interpreting pre-industrial life in Sweden. And that is the kind of like the foundation of living history museums, which is what Stern Museum is. That's kind of where we base our start off. And then jumping across the pond over to America, we don't do it until 1928 with the Greenfield Village, the Henry Ford Greenfield Village.
They're the first one.
1928. Mm-hmm. So it's the collection of all these buildings being brought together to help tell stories of the past. But it's also all the objects that they start to collect to help them interpret those stories.
Very cool. I can't let the segment pass without turning to literature, because one of the things we could have talked about a great deal more was the subject of when collections go wrong.
Yes.
And the subject of hoarding is not a recent phenomena. If you think it is, it's
people have been collecting, they've been hoarders.
Exactly. And there's no bigger account than that in Dante Alighieri's The Inferno, when he talks about the hoarders being condemned to the fourth circle of hell, where they are doomed forever to battle with the wasters, in quotation marks, by crashing heavy stones against one another for their sin of materialism. Yeah, it's crazy. And then here we are, like, that's, you know, we're going to hit pause for right now. And when we come back, we are going to be traveling to Heartland Antiques in downtown Grand Island. And we're going to be talking with a dealer and a proprietor of the collecting trade. So stick with us, and we'll be back after these words.
Today's podcast is brought to you by First State Bank of Railroad Town. The First State Bank of Railroad Town was established in 1879, is located on the southwest corner of Depot and South Front Street, and has a cash capital of $100,000. Savings deposits received and interest allowed. Transactions, a general banking business on the most favorable of terms. Mr. D. Butler, the head cashier, is ready to help you. Your money can grow with us at First State Bank.
Welcome back to the Stir Crazy Podcast. We are at Heartland Antiques here in downtown Grand Island. We are joined by a whole host of characters. Jim Pohl here over at the Heartland Antiques. Are you the proprietor of this fine establishment?
Yes, I am the owner. We opened in 1986. We moved into this building in 1991. Before that, we were in the historic GAR building up the street, GAR building. And then we were in another location, and then we've been here ever since.
Gotcha. And also with us are Kay Sanova from Stir Museum, Carly Kramers from Stir Museum, Carrie Stover from Stir Museum, and Deb Maley, who is a dealer here at the Heartland Antique Mall. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We're just going to get a whole host of perspectives on the ideas surrounding collecting and the history thereof. It's a fascinating topic. I think people have always been collecting, I think, as long as there have been people.
Yes.
Why do you think, though, that people collect things? Is there a rationale as to why that is? We'll start with you, Jim. Not to put you on the spot.
What are some of the... I mean, surely you've had people who've come into the store who say, I'm looking specifically for these
types. Oh, yeah. I mean, people collect all sorts of things. I mean, I think we went through a phase, not to get off on a tangent, but in the 90s, I think collecting stuff was very popular. I was just having a conversation with somebody the other day about how they used to drive to Hastings. Like, he and his wife would drive to Hastings because they were releasing a new Beanie Baby.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, back then it was, you know, Hallmark ornaments and Boyd's Bears. And, you know, there were just all these prints.
Pocahontas cups at McDonald's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was just like this huge collectible market. And the antique business... like, people collected everything back then. It was Depression glass and Fire King, and
I was into pitchers at that time.
Yeah,
different sizes of pitchers.
Just tons and tons of collectibles. And then I don't know. In the early 2000s, it seemed like it kind of all that stuff really cooled for a while. But weirdly, in the last year, I've been getting a lot of people coming in and starting to, they're really looking for things now again. So
is it primarily people who are, you know, looking to flip things for profit? Is it for a love of the item itself? You know, is
no, it, it's mostly just to have it.
To have their thing, yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah.
What's kind of like a unique thing about this institution comparative to the other stores that are in Grand Island? I feel like it's a unique part of town that there are so many, you know, there's so many antique stores in Grand Island, for those of you who aren't familiar. So I'm wondering, like, why is that the case, I guess?
But I think it's because it's a natural kind of center for people. A lot of people who come here for shopping reasons and all of that other stuff. We're along Interstate 80. A lot of people travel it, and they stop specifically. There have been a number of events over the years that will draw people to Grand Island for to look at things, and the antique dealers I have found have been really good at promoting all of their venues so that they can stay in the mindset of people who are looking for things.
back in the 90s, there were, I think there were 14 shops in Grand Island. And somebody asked me one time, it's like, oh, don't you think that's, you know, too many? And it's like, no. If the more you have, it's a unique business, because the more shops you have in an area, the more reason people will get off the interstate and come to visit. And it's not like, everybody's inventories. Yeah, and that's a prime example. Walnut, Iowa is pretty much just all antique stores. It's a little dinky town, and their whole main street is just shop after shop after shop.
Yeah. And, you could basically spend several days just trolling through all the stores.
Yeah.
So as websites like eBay became more popularized, did you see a drastic decrease of those collectors knowing they could just like Google something and get exactly what they wanted? Or were people still wanting that hunt and to feel things and to see things in person?
That's a good question. When eBay became popular, everybody was, you know, they were just convinced that shops like ours would really suffer. I never really saw it. And it is people when they're collecting things, it's the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right? It's the hunt that people like. And eBay, it's a little too easy. And it's also, I don't know, you just never quite know what you're, you know, people are being honest.
I've run across on eBay where they'll say, this is an original magazine, because I have this thing about magazines too, and turn out their reproductions. And mm-hmm. if they would just have looked at it, they would have seen that it was a reproduction, but they're convinced. And even when I pointed it out, they didn't take too kindly to me pointing out that it was a reproduction and not an original Ladies' Home Journal from the 1890s. Okay. So.
Well, I assume, Jim, that you're a collector of some type. What are the items that you collect?
Big collection currently. And I think that's the other thing, too, is people, you know, they'll collect things for a while, and then they get tired of them, and they sell them. But right now, I collect something called mercury glass.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, they made all sorts of things, vases and just globes and everything else. And it's basically glass that has the mercury coating, the silver coating on the inside, and it looks pretty cool when you have like all kinds of lights on it and stuff.
Where do you find stuff like that for your own collection?
It comes in here mostly. Is where I've got most of it, and that's the other thing too. When people find out that you collect something, it makes it easy, you know, for Christmas time, birthdays, everything else.
That's how I get all my chickens.
Yeah, you do chickens, don't you?
Yes.
So with the emotional aspect of collecting, would you say that there's like a slight addiction to the adrenaline rush when you find that perfect thing that you've been hunting for? How would you describe that for people that don't collect?
No, that's, I think you just described it better than I could. It's perfect. I think it's just a fun scavenger hunt kind of a thing.
I was going to bring Deb in for a second. So you must be a collector as well, but you're also a dealer. How did you kind of go down into that area? Did you start out collecting and kind of frequenting places like Heartland, or how did you arrive at being a dealer?
Well, I was a customer here for a long time, not a frequent customer, but enough to kind of know what the shop was about. And my son-in-law and his wife moved to Maine because he was serving in the Navy, and that's where he was stationed. And I went out to visit them. I have been through New England before, but not to the extent that I did on that particular visit. And what I found in all of the New England formerly colonies for antiques absolutely thrilled me. Sure. I did not know there were still items that were that old that you could actually take home with you.
Yeah.
And the Revolutionary War period, that's my thing. I love that part of history. And you can actually find things back there that go back that far.
Yeah.
So for me, the draw to antiques is the history. And often more primitive than fancy things. You know, what did the everyday colonist need? what appealed to him. It's just fascinating to me. It's that part of history that draws me to antiques.
I totally agree. We're kindred spirits in that way. A really cool thing that I happened to see when I was in Virginia one time was a spoon that was made by Paul Revere.
Yes.
Because everyone knows, you know, oh, hey, Paul Revere, Midnight Ride and all that. But he actually was a person and had a trade. And he was a silversmith who made spoons. And the fact that it said it on the back. It had his maker's mark on the back of the spoon. And
exactly.
It's so crazy that something like that is like, yeah, here you go. For $70,000, you can have it. But still.
Oh, is that all?
Or I don't know. I don't remember how much it was, but it was a lot of money.
Probably
but
that, yeah.
That some of that stuff exists to me. I mean, there's a term for it in academia. It's called material culture.
Yes.
But it's super cool.
So is it hard for you, like when you find stuff like that, to then like turn it over to be sold?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, you guys are so excited and everything.
I'll tell you what.
How do you do that?
On one of our trips back there. It was an antique buying trip, and we flew out, my husband and I flew out and drove back a 26-foot U-Haul truck that was packed to the gills because, I mean, it took a second mortgage out on the house. I mean, it just was fascinating to me, and we were going to remodel our house extensively. And I didn't know what would fit. And I didn't know what for sure I wanted to keep. Or I wanted to keep it all, but I couldn't. Sure. So Jim provided a booth for me. And my leftovers have been coming in ever since. But there are times I see them go out the door and I think, what did I do?
Yeah. No, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are in similar situations like that. I don't nearly have enough that I would ever have a booth, but I feel like sometimes I have no idea what I'm actually going to end up doing with this stuff if ever the time comes. Just kind of shifting gears again. Jim, I'm asking you this, but anybody can answer. Who are the dealers? Are they all like a similar breed of person? Is it just a conglomeration of everybody?
Yeah, but there are similarities between everybody, I think, that collects.
I think dealers sometimes the what I think what I've in talking to some, being a dealer kind of validates their collection habits. They can collect things,
right,
but then they have a way to, as they tire something, that they can find a new home for that precious to go to another caretaker, and kind of pass it on.
I think that's what happens is that, you know, you start as a collector and then your collection gets to be so big. And then it's like, you know, like as what you were just talking about, you know, you have to start getting rid of some stuff. And so then, you know, that's most collectors, not most, but all dealers started out as collectors. And
I think that there's a great tradition here that we're kind of the ancestors of. Starting with the cabinets of curiosity from the old world in Europe. Like that's kind of how they started is people started collecting these things that were rare, the people who were affluent at least, who had places to display them. But their collections would grow so large that they would allow people in to come see them. And I don't know how much selling was involved, but they were certainly proud of their collections and wanted them displayed in some way, shape or form. And here we are several thousand years.
I think they went two different directions. I think that some went to antique dealers and then some went museum direction.
Yeah.
I think that there's, because it's kind of a parallel path, but I think they just kind of went different directions because, you know, we have collections of a lot of beautiful material culture things, and so do antique stores.
Yeah, and I mean, and artwork plays a huge part in that as well. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, a lot of these collections were fine art, so you wanted to make sure that you took especially good care of those sorts of pieces. And it was by these patrons who had a ton of money and were able to really showcase them in such a way that kind of mirrored really high class institutions today in several ways, I think.
So with the buyers, do you see them as a specific demographic of age, or with the rise of hipster culture, have you seen more young people coming in to hop on the boat collecting?
Yeah, most of our demographic, I think, skews a little older. Younger people. Now, in the last year, I have been seeing a lot of younger people coming in, but they're looking for more mid-century, more 70s. And it kind of has to be functional. I think that younger people don't really want a cabinet full of
tchotchkes.
Yeah. I think that it has to be more functional. You know, Pyrex is really hot right now. Pyrex glass, mm-hmm. like baking dishes and that kind of thing from the 70s and 80s, I guess, you know. Yeah. But
I think it's generational. I mean, you collect kind of what your childhood and teen years dictated for you.
Yeah, then I'm way off.
Well, maybe not. my dad is in the car world, and, you know, it's kind of an older demographic, but the people who are younger aren't collecting a 65 mm-hmm. Mustang anymore. They want, like, an IROC Z28 Camaro from the 80s. You know, like, it's just, like, that next wave is, yep. like, where they, yep. their interests are, because that's what they had when they were younger.
But I think being someone that receives donations at the museum, we've seen a difference in that there are not as many hand-me-downs. There's not as many people wanting to collect 3-4 generations down the road. They're done. They don't want to store that at their house.
Yep.
And so has that, I mean, that's definitely affected our world. Do you see that happening here?
Yeah. One of the things that I hear quite often is when people say, older people, you know, oh, we've collected this stuff for years, but we don't really know what we're going to do with it because our kids don't want it.
Right.
And that kind of breaks my heart a little bit, you know.
It's
but like I said, I feel like it's turning around a little bit. I think that the younger generation, I think they are finding some value in some of this stuff. And I don't know if it's the COVID thing, you know, or I don't know.
There's a lot of really nice and antique stuff, especially furniture and things like that. The construction is oftentimes so much better than modern furniture.
Yes.
And so the functionality is, I mean, things have lasted 50, 100 years or more, and they're still functional. So why not invest in something that is proven and get that piece and have that in your home and not have to worry about replacing it every 2 years because the pressed cardboard is falling.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like that's definitely part of why younger generations like the more functional antiques, because like of the whole economic crisis that they're in with jobs where they only have so much money to spend. So there's probably that appeal of getting something you can use in your house, but then also has that antique value to it.
Yeah. Well, and character. Character is a big thing, you know. It's a lot of really unique pieces in here. And
And the current generation is such a wanting to be unique and not conforming to norms, etc. So getting unique pieces that no one else has, even if they're not expensive, is kind of what they're after, more than just the thing at IKEA that everybody can get anytime they want. Speaking of that topic, has there been anything like a super, you know, unique quality that's managed to come in here that maybe you weren't expecting, that you can recall?
You've had some pretty cool mid-century stuff over here.
Yeah, mid-century. A lot of really good primitives. You know, the not the more formal antiques, but, you know, one of our dealers, Deb, you have a lot of really nice, you know, authentic antiques.
Let me just point this out. You were talking about how well-made things used to be. That cupboard's 225 years old.
Wow.
And it's probably just about as good in as good a shape as it was when it was built. I'm just saying.
And still functional.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you. That's what you're selling, Deb?
Yeah, this is my booth.
Is there anything particularly difficult that you're struggling to put out here for sale?
Yeah, just pick a room in my house. It's pretty full. I did sell one item that I about give my eye teeth to have back. I have one, but I sold a better one in better condition. It was a 1700s leather fire bucket.
Oh, yeah.
That, yes.
They
and
didn't make them out of wood yet.
No. And it still carried the Boston Fire Department paint on the front of it.
Wow.
Yeah, that should never have left my house. Yeah.
That's I can't really remember something. If I actually got to see that or not.
It went about the same night it came in.
Oh. Yeah. Well, yeah, I imagine somebody would go, oh, this is special.
I had a dealer one time that he never would take pictures of his stuff because he didn't want to be reminded of what he didn't have anymore.
Sure.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, thank you all for being
Maybe
here.
Maybe somebody will hear it on the yeah. podcast yeah. and offer you.
I go, where's that 200-year-old?
Yeah, thank you all for being on the podcast today. Those are great stories. Encourage everyone to come down to Heartland Antiques anytime you're in the neighborhood and buy something from one of these great dealers that have a lot of cool stuff on display.